From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
Napa, California.
I live in the Castro.
Fillmore District.
Vernal Heights.
Oakland, California.
Coming up, we'll find out what life is like for detained, undocumented immigrants.
Once you're released, you have to wait like 6 months to a year sometimes to get a work permit. So I had to move from place to place.
Then we'll learn the secret that unlocked a new life for the historic immigration station at Angel Island.
Some of the higher-ups thought this was not a good story to tell because it was a story of racism. History is history. You can't just spin it to say it never happened.
And we'll feel our way through the latest sonic clue from our audiograph team.
I feel sort of like being trapped inside the bouncy castle of my nightmares.
Don't worry, we're looking out for you today on Cross Currents. The West County Detention Facility is a medium security jail in Richmond. It holds men and women arrested for or convicted of crimes, as you might expect, and it also holds undocumented immigrants. From 2008 until late last year, Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, checked fingerprints from local police bookings against its immigration database in a program known as Secure Communities. At the time, when the agency discovered that someone who'd been arrested was also undocumented, they would detain that person at a place like West County. Last November, the Department of Homeland Security declared a change in policy. ICE would detain only undocumented immigrants accused of certain crimes, like espionage, gang activity, and domestic violence. But they still check fingerprints, and immigrant advocates say people are still at risk of being detained. Unless you know someone's being held, you might never be aware that the county jail doubles as an immigration detention center. A coalition of East Bay churches wants to change that. On the first Saturday of every month, the Interfaith Coalition for Immigrant Rights holds a vigil outside the facility. KALW's Mary Rees has been spending time there and brings us this report.
Every month, Alex Aldana stands in protest in front of the West County Detention Facility in Richmond. On this first Saturday of December, he tells his story to about 100 supporters. Many hold posters, noisemakers, or musical instruments.
As somebody that is undocumented, I fully didn't understand what it was like to be in detention until recently.
Aldana first came to the United States with his mother when he was 11, and he's lived here ever since. In December 2013, at age 26, he traveled to Mexico to see his dying grandmother. In early 2014, he tried to come back to the U.S. and asked for asylum.
I came here, quote-unquote, the right way. I presented myself to the border, and I was handcuffed. I was actually chained from my feet to my waist to my neck, and for the simple reason of asking for asylum.
He was taken to a detention facility like this one, but in San Diego. Like most immigrants in his situation, Aldana didn't know how long he would be held or when he'd have a hearing, whether he'd be released or simply deported.
For us that have been detained, just being in a little space in a white room, not knowing what's going to happen to your case, not knowing if you're going to see your family the next day, it's nerve-breaking.
Reverend Deborah Lee is director of the Interfaith Coalition for Immigrant Rights, which coordinates these monthly vigils for the immigrants inside.
Those who are in every way are refugees, but they're not being treated like refugees, they are being criminalized.
Lee's coalition holds the events to raise awareness
and to draw attention to the suffering that happens to the families and to the individuals who go through that process.
After the vigil, Alex Aldana stands in the sunshine near the jail entrance and talks about what life is like now that he's out of detention. He was released on bail after nearly 3 months and has a lawyer and a case pending for asylum. But he still doesn't feel secure.
I was lucky to get a bond. My bond was really expensive, so coming from a low-income family was really harsh. It destroyed our little economy that we had, you know, and again, you can't even work. Once you're released, you have to wait like six months to a year sometimes to get a work permit. So I had to move from place to place, having that trauma of like being chased or even, you know, like being at risk of being deported again, you know. It's something that I live with every day.
There are 92 immigrants being held at West County right now. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, says on average they'll be here 1 month, though Deborah Lee says some, like Alex Aldana, will be held longer. Some people inside this facility will be deported. Others will be released on bail and expected to show up in immigration court. In the meantime, if they have family or friends nearby, they can have visitors.
No jackets, hats, sunglasses, or cell phones, no purses or wallets, nothing in your pockets.
In late January, I go back to the county jail for visiting hours. About 8 or 9 people are waiting in the lobby as a sheriff's deputy reads the visitor's rules.
You're not allowed to bring anything inside except one single key, the key to your car, the key to a locker.
Coming for a visit is not easy. For starters, the official Contra Costa County website lists different visiting days from what's posted here in the lobby. Visitors must arrive at least 30 minutes beforehand to register, and they're faced with a long list of rules.
There's a dress code on the front of the desk. You're responsible to know the dress code. Also, you must clear the metal detector.
Access isn't easy for reporters either. The Contra Costa Sheriff's Department declined an interview and referred me to an ICE spokesperson, who also declined, though she did answer questions by email. None of the sheriff's deputies at the facility were willing to talk on tape during my 2 visits. But I could record in the jail lobby. Many people I spoke with feared that their friends or relatives arrested for minor violations would be held longer because of their immigration status.
We may be going through in about 10 minutes.
Fidel Sanchez is here to visit a friend whom he says ICE agents picked up a week earlier in San Francisco's Bayview neighborhood.
Somebody reported he was working in the with no paper. Yeah. And ICE was waiting for him in front of the house with you know, he catch it before he went to work.
In a 3-minute phone call from jail, his friend said he was worried about his family back in Honduras, where the new school year starts in February.
They supposed to wait for money for you know, for paid for the school stuff. But it's not possible. But I make a carousel the last week. I get some money I sent to the family to Honduras. The kid can go to school.
Immigrants like Sanchez's friend and Alex Aldana say that's one of the hardest things about detention, the disruption of income and family life. President Obama's recent executive order would offer temporary protection to about 1/3 of the undocumented immigrants currently in the U.S. The protection is uneven, however. For example, Alex Aldana's mother would qualify, but Aldana himself would not. A federal judge put a halt on that executive order in mid-February, and Congress is looking for ways to defund it. Until then, everybody waits. In Richmond, I'm Mary Reese for Cross Currents.
Earlier this week, the House and Senate agreed on a bill to fund the Department of Homeland Security. The bill does not mention immigration. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The San Francisco Bay has long been a gateway for immigrants. Between 1910 and 1940, more than 1 million people from 80 different countries entered the U.S. through the immigration station on Angel Island. It was called the Ellis Island of the West. But after World War II, the station was shut down and neglected. In 2009, the immigration station was restored and classified as a National Historic Landmark. But it all wouldn't have happened if not for one man who unveiled a long-forgotten secret. Back in 2005, I went to Angel Island to hear his story and bring you this report from the Cross Currents Archive. On a clear day, the ferry ride to Angel Island is a soothing experience, with majestic views of the Golden Gate Bridge, the island's lush greenery, and the sun's rays glistening off the bay waters. Alex Weiss was a ranger here at Angel Island State Park in 1970. One day, he wandered into one of the old buildings on the island that was scheduled for demolition that year. It used to be an army barracks, as far as he knew. The Guardian of the Western Gates, they called it. He was walking through the rundown barracks with his flashlight when he noticed something on the walls.
And I came through and I saw these calligraphy Chinese carvings on the wall. And I said, wow, that's pretty impressive. And then I kept going, into this main room, which was a dormitory for Chinese detainees, and noticed that the entire walls were covered with calligraphy.
It turned out Weiss had stumbled upon a secret hidden for decades. It wasn't just calligraphy. It was poetry.
My freedom withheld. How can I bear to talk about it? I look to see who is happy, but they only sit quietly. I am anxious and depressed and cannot fall asleep. The days are long and the bottle constantly empty.
140 Chinese poems were carved into the barrack's wooden walls, and they shared a common theme: sadness, misery, and humiliation. They revealed a forgotten past on the island. Before it was an army barracks, the building was a detention center for the island's immigration station in 1910, called the Ellis Island of the West. This bell sounded whenever a new ship of Chinese immigrants was approaching Angel Island in the early 1900s. They were met with officials who herded them into overcrowded detention barracks for interrogation. Immigrants lived in the barracks between 1 week to 2 years. Robert Fung is an Asian history professor at San Francisco State University. He says it was the first time a group was named by race to be excluded from coming into the country.
The Chinese Exclusion Act, written in 1882, said that if you're a Chinese, if you're a Chinese laborer, you cannot come to America. You know, the law was made specifically to target the Chinese. It was later amended to make it even more restrictive because the view, the mythology of the Chinese was that they were here to take our jobs away, cheap labor competition.
It felt like a jail.
Lai Keng Wong arrived at Angel Island when she was just 7 years old. Her father was living in Oakland and sent for her and her sisters to come to America to receive an education, something that wasn't available to them in China.
I was traumatized because I told you about the locked doors, the bar windows, and the way the guards treated us. Whenever we wanted to talk, they would try to look at us. We were told what time to eat. We were told what time to go to the bathroom. There was no such thing as a book available for us to read. There was no such thing as anything, like even little toys for kids to play with.
Conditions at the station were fit for unwelcome guests. Detainees like Lai Keng slept in thin metal triple bunk beds. They had to disrobe in groups of 30 for intimate medical exams. The doors were locked and guarded. The poems on the walls told countless stories.
Curled up in an enclosure, my movements are dictated by others. Enduring 100 humiliations, I can only cry in vain. This person's tears fall, but what can the blue heavens do?
Hoping to save the barracks from demolition, Alex Weiss told his superiors about the poems. He says they weren't interested and told him they had other plans for the land. But Weiss says he's always believed there was another reason.
Maybe some of the higher-ups thought this was not a good story to tell because it was a story of racism and bad treatment of Americans to immigrants.
Weiss didn't take no for an answer. He and Lai Keng Wong joined Bay Area Chinese Americans to spearhead a vigorous public awareness campaign. That led to a 2000 California vote assigning $15 million for the preservation and restoration of the immigration station. A chain of federal, state, and private funds followed, taking it off the list of the 11 most endangered historic sites in America. In 2005, the Angel Island station was closed for renovation. The renovations include a new museum. Visitors will be able to see live reenactments of how immigrants were checked in and interrogated in the early 1900s.
The Chinese people and the people from the Far East have contributed just as much as the European immigrants who came through Ellis Island.
For those like Lai Keng Wong, who lived through the Angel Island experience, seeing the station restored is important, no matter how bleak that picture may be.
And Each strand in our flag will represent some segments of the different ethnic groups. And I feel very strongly if we pull out one of the strands, let's say the Chinese strand, it's no longer United States history.
As for Ranger Weiss, he says he's proud to be a part of the movement that saved a crucial part of the American story.
We need to face our history, whether it's not that honorable for us to some of the things we did and also some of the good things we did. So history is history. You can't just spin it to say it never happened.
A note to our listeners, former Ranger Alex Weiss passed away in October of last year. He did live long enough to witness in 2010 the 100th anniversary of the opening of the immigration station when President Obama declared every January 21st National Angel Island Day. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's Audiograph's Julie Kane.
For today's Audiograph, we're going dark.
See, no one's glasses. You're not going to need them because you can't see.
Wait, did you go? Are we going? Oh, we can go. Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Okay, I found you.
Okay.
Oh my God, it's big.
Oh my God. Okay. Wait. I can't find where to go through.
This is scary.
Oh, I think the ceiling.
Oh, whoa, the ceiling's really close to your face.
Oh yeah. Ah!
There's something tripping.
Okay, that's a lot of shrieking. But you know what? I can relate. The last time I was in this place, inching my way through this darkened, texture-filled obstacle course, I didn't know where I was going or what exactly I was touching. And that's the idea. What started as a psychedelic art experiment is now the largest exhibit at the Exploratorium. We sent KALW's Hannah Kingsley Ma on a quest to find out more.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the sound of a radio reporter lost inside the tactile dome.
I'm not sure I would have found that without the light.
At this moment, I am crawling on my hands and knees, feeling my way through the dark. My tape recorder is slung around my neck. I sort of trapped myself into a corner. But before we go any further, let's go back in time, back to when the dome was first built in 1971.
And all of a sudden it became this like art, you know, collaborative thing. You would come in and experience, you know, very psychedelic. And then, I don't know, somewhere in the 80s it became this like kids' birthday party thing.
That's Marcella Grease. She's the manager at the Tactile Dome. She even got her first kiss here. She's been working at the Exploratorium since she was 14.
I was getting paid to, like, learn about science. It was pretty awesome.
The Tactile Dome was the brainchild of Carl Day, a gallery owner, Keith Wallach, an architect, and Dr. August F. Coppola, a college professor at San Francisco State. If Coppola's name sounds familiar, that's because his brother directed a small art house film called The Godfather.
Don't ask me about my business, Kate.
Is it true?
Don't ask me about my business.
No!
Dr. Coppola and his team wanted to create an exhibit in which people would have to rely on touch rather than sight. They believed that society imposed too many rules against touching, especially in museums.
Welcome to the Dome. Have you guys done this before?
No.
Anyone who has glasses, you're not going to need them because you can't see. So you can put them on the counter before you go in, and any hats or, like, loose, no glow-in-the-dark watches or phones, those are not allowed inside the dome.
It's time to go in. We take off our shoes, our glasses, and we empty out our pockets. That's because it's easy to lose things as you crawl through the pitch black. currently in the lost and found are a small plastic pig and a miniature stapler.
I opened the door going through and I was like, is that a sandwich? And I took it out and it was like someone's turkey sandwich with like their name on it.
The first group enters. Liz Delborn, who helped design the new dome, watches on a monitor. It's part of a new system that uses infrared light to help her see in the dark. There is also a speaker system, so Delborn can provide assistance when needed.
Hey, are you okay in there?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Okay, I'm so glad. You guys keep talking because then I know which way to go.
My group's fearless leader is Allie Sweeney, a 13-year-old from Lafayette. She's here with a friend, her little brother, and her mom, Renee.
I'm hoping not to get claustrophobic. That's what I'm hoping to.
We enter total darkness. To my complete surprise, I am 100% terrified.
Okay, so I'm in the tactile dome. I'm honestly pretty frightened.
The Sweeneys fearlessly charge ahead. I try to follow them, but end up lagging behind.
Are you guys still here?
Tangled up in my own neuroses and also an actual net. My eyes haven't adjusted to the dark yet. I keep bumping into walls, feeling intermittent patches of metal and everyday objects made unrecognizable by the blackness of the maze.
Feels sort of like being trapped inside the bouncy castle of my nightmares.
After what feels like an interminable period of time, I stagger out into the light, bleary-eyed and disoriented. I am very happy to be on the outside, though it becomes clear I was the only one in the group who struggled.
I thought it was fantastic.
I thought it was awesome. I want to do it again.
The technicians direct my attention to Josh Kammerker, a man in the previous group. He walked right into the dome, only to walk right back out again.
Total panic. Claustrophobia. You take a step in, and everything closes in on you. There's no light. You can't see anything.
Did it take you by surprise, your reaction?
A little bit. I didn't think it would be that all immersing. Like, I didn't think I would feel everything all at once, but it was pretty intense.
Do you think you'll go back in?
I don't think so. That's it.
Marcella Grease tells me that she anticipated Kammerker's response. She's gotten pretty good at spotting the telltale signs of a very nervous participant, and that it's often split down the middle between kids and adults.
I knew that guy was going to freak out.
How did you know?
Because he came in and he was really quiet and he was kind of shaky.
The Exploratorium is actively trying to recruit older participants back to the dome. They've created an experience specifically tailored for adults as part of the museum's After Dark events. Grease even commissioned a soundtrack of nocturnal sounds, hoping they'd alleviate some of the anxieties adults feel in the dome, as well as enhance the overall experience. I decide to go back in to put our theory to the test. Maybe it's because this is my second time, or maybe it's because of the strangely comforting sounds of nighttime tree frogs. But all my fear melts away. I'm actually taking the time to touch things, my hands outstretched and curious.
Those were like beads that were hanging from the ceiling that were sort of like tingling my back. It was like rain.
I end up staying inside the tactile dome for almost 30 minutes. The technicians have to gently coax me out. The final descent before I exit is pure euphoria.
You can come down.
All right.
This is by far the best room.
I can't reveal what's making that sound. Grease and her comrades swore me to secrecy. What I can say is that in true San Francisco fashion, it is both locally sourced and organic. You'll just have to close your eyes, take a deep breath, and find out for yourself. In San Francisco, I'm Hannah Kingsley Ma for Cross Currents.
Lots of you called in with the right answer this week. Our winner is Stacy Castle. She and her kids, there are six of them, Chase, Lauren, Tyler, Devin, Arden, and Beau, were just in the Tactile Dome last week.
All is dark.
Stacy, we're going to send you a KALW t-shirt.
All is quiet.
For the rest of you, we'll have another mystery sound next week.
Thanks, Julie. And now we'd love to hear from you. Email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW or call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Sandhya Dirks, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Hannah Kingsley-Ma, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Raja Shah, Stephen Short, and Judy Silber. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.